All right, once again, the It's Going Down podcast. Thank you for joining us. Today we have a very special group that you may not have ever heard of before, called Heathens United Against Racism. They come out of the pagan and heathen circles of earth-based spirituality, and they were part of a pushback against white nationalists, the alt-right, and white supremacists that were coming into their circles and trying to use these earth-based spiritualities to kind of further their own movement. And they're going to talk about how they organize with other people, and regardless if you're spiritual, maybe this is something that you've never heard of, you're not even interested in, we think it's interesting to talk about how these people came together and really started to push back against white nationalists and alt-right ideas coming into where they were at. And maybe this will provide something that sparks something for you that can provide a little bit of a push to get involved in something that matters to you where you live. Thanks a lot for Heathens United Against Racism. Let's get to it. All right, we're joined here today with three people from the group Heathens United Against Racism. Did I get it right?
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So we're going to be talking today about spiritual movements that have built up walls against fascism, against the alt-right, against people basically using pagan or heathen movements, ideas, spirituality to create a white supremacist wedge within them. And even if you're not spiritual or you have a different path or what have you, I think it's really fascinating what you all have done over the past couple of years of really pushing back against this. And I think this kind of serves as, you know, some really great examples of what a lot of people could do in a variety of subcultures, scenes, movements, groups, places of coming together. It doesn't really matter. So for those of us that don't come from a spiritual background, or for people that don't know, can we just define heathenism and paganism? Are they synonymous? Are they one and the same? Are they different? What do you mean when you use these terms?
I'd say paganism is like a big umbrella term for a variety of polytheisms and New Age ideologies as well. And that heathenry or heathenism, as you said, is more specifically Germanic neo-paganism or Germanic pagan reconstructionism, which is where you have a set of basically ethnic traditions from continental Europe and the rest of Northern Europe, Northern continental Europe and Northern Europe and Scandinavia being reconstructed and put into action, I would say.
I like to say that the correlation between paganism and heathenry is the same as between squares and rectangles. You know, all squares are rectangles, but not all rectangles are squares.
Yeah.
One group falls within the other, but they are not necessarily synonymous. There is also a large movement within heathenry right now to kind of distance ourselves from the rest of the pagan community, which is just kind of interesting. It's been interesting to kind of watch unfold, because for a long time, heathens were fighting like hell just to like get recognized in the pagan community, which is fairly Wicca-centric. They seem to just kind of give up on that. Like, nope, we're just going to – you guys can just go over there.
It also has – and that's something that's important to point out – very different – origins, like related but different origins from the broader, more Wiccan influenced pagan community, where they like to point to which communities in the British Isles in the 1950s starting to become more public following the repeal of different anti-witchcraft laws. Heathens draw our modern origins from groups who were active in Scandinavia and Iceland, who were like had been for years prior in like looking at different practices and folklore and starting to build something up. And the first example of heathen practice being recognized as an official religion anywhere in the world was in Iceland in 1972. And that's kind of where heathen practice came from. So it's a little more folkloric and a little less, I don't know, because Wicca borrows a lot of stuff from things like the Order of the Golden Dawn and the Freemasons and all of them. So
So paganism is a broad term that encompasses a variety of belief systems and spiritual practices, and heathenry is a subset within that that's coming from a specific place in the world or has its origins there.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned Wicca, and I know that Ryan from Gods and Radicals, who was on here before, kind of mentioned that Wicca was something that was recently created, and that I don't know if you want to get into the history of that. I think when most people think paganism, they think Wiccan ideas.
Instead of our occult practices, our magical practices and things like that, they are anchored to specific kind of terms and ideas from specific times and places. And they're not the center of what we do. Definitely not. That stuff is kind of secondary to, I mean, depending on, unless you're a witch, I guess.
So let's just talk about how the group got started. What caused it to get to, you know, you to form a group, you know, Heathens United Against Racism? Was there something that was building within these communities for a long time? Did it take a while for this group to come around, or was it something that was formed very quickly? And let's just really get into what led to this group being formed. Like, what were the things that actually happened that made people want to form this group?
Well, kind of what got it, the issues over racism and fascism have been present in heathenry almost since it got started. When you go back and look at different examples in the United States as well as in Europe, there, and even before like the 1972 recognition of practice in Iceland, there have been different groups that have been latching on to the practice, the folklore that we draw on for justifying racist practice. I mean, the Nazis co-opted all kinds of symbols, although not really anything beyond that. I don't think there was any specific moment that caused it. When the first members of HUAR came together, like the one thing that we had in common was previously in 2011, there was the whole thing of Occupy and everything else that happened in 2011. And there was a group of heathens that came together who were supportive or involved in the Occupy movement in some way or another. And out of that, there were a number of conversations led to going, hey, maybe we should get at least some kind of discussion going about how to do this. And it's slowly evolved over time since then. There's definitely been a number of different setbacks as well as dead ends, but it's kind of been a steady, organic process. There have been specific moments that have really accelerated things, but I don't think there was any one moment that really kicked it off, so to speak.
Okay. So the group formed around 2011, post-Occupy?
Like 2012.
Okay. Well, let's just talk about, I mean, how in the current context we're talking about, you know, five or so years ago, what was the process like of fascist groups or white supremacist or white nationalist groups starting to enter into heathen and pagan circles? What did that look like? What did they do? Why?
It started out, I mean, pretty innocuously. Like, the people who really were dead set, well, with some exceptions, the people who were really dead set at actually building something in the heathen community were people who were very careful about what they were saying and what they were doing. So they were manufacturing respectability for the space that they wanted. So like even some of their own allies probably didn't agree with all their views, but they also didn't know all their views. So they kind of found a way to be a chameleon, if that makes sense.
They've always, to some degree or another, they've always been there. There's just been periods when they become more and less prominent and more and less visible. So it's something that's a bit it's something that is very unique to the experience of the heathen community, of that there isn't a specific point where we can say this is when the entryism began, because it's been happening at different points
right
throughout the history of this community.
Well, I was just curious if you could paint a picture, because I think most people are imagining people sitting by the fire doing something, singing a song, and then like some guy walks up and is like, "Hey guys, how about Hitler or something?" Like, you know, what did it, like, how did people become aware that people with fascist ideas that were trying to build a base for those ideas begin to, you know, take up space in this community? Like, what did it look like, and how did people kind of start to notice it?
I mean, one of the features that's at least big for heathenry is heritage. And it's not uncommon for heritage movements in, like, that are practiced in white tribalistic kinds of contexts to get almost instantly peed on by these kinds of people. And I think that's kind of how it happened. As soon as they heard, oh, there's like gods for me and for my roots, it's almost like right away it got co-opted. And these people come kind of selling a kind of snake oil. Like, they talk about they don't talk about identitarian politics. They talk about looking in the mirror and seeing who you are and connecting with a lost spirituality. And I mean, it sold pretty well for a while. But like Ryan said, there's really no one point where this happened. There were theodish type movements in England and Germany. And as soon as those got started, instantly you had like hyper nationalist types jump on and try to make their claim there. Yeah. And separately, you had movements like this in England, where as soon as they became even slightly notable, groups of former fascist political partisans decided, well, this is for us. And then they'd make their own thing, almost to compete with the people already working these sorts of things. So there's really no point. Like, every time these form, even in a vacuum, some fascist comes on board and says, maybe I can make my chips here.
Mm-hmm. I think particularly in America, there's this long-standing issue with the concept of white and whiteness, and which groups are qualified in that, and which exactly, you know, what exactly that means. And in a lot of ways, the entire category of white is kind of used to erase heritage. It's used to, you know, you're no longer of Scottish descent or Irish descent or Italian descent. Like, you're white now. Especially once you've been here for a few generations, you kind of just get pulled into this amorphous government-issued grouping. And I see that used a lot by the fascist types as a, you know, well, don't you feel that, you know, you don't have that real kind of ancestral connection like these other groups that are allowed to have pride movements, but you're not, because that would be racist, and that, you know, isn't that unfair? Rah, rah, white pride.
Which is interesting, because it's like, I don't know, isn't this stuff like, it's not about whiteness, it's about connecting to supposedly some ancestral place that's not even, you know, tied to, you know, Germany or Scandinavia or some sort of country, but a place that existed before those state barriers were even put into place. And, you know, this, you know, ancestral tie to the land and, you know, a spiritual practice and the way people relate to that and so on and so forth, that it has nothing to do with whiteness. I mean, whiteness is this blanket thing that takes all these different kinds of people and puts them in a social caste in America that makes sense, you know, in that power structure, but everywhere else, I don't know. It seems bizarre that people would arrive at that conclusion, like basically using these things, which have nothing really to do with whiteness per se. They're about, you know, connecting to something ancient and using that to strengthen, you know, the social category in the Americas of whiteness.
I mean, 1,500 years of colonization has made, I mean, just about everybody who's touched by like imperial colonization loses some connection to their identity in some way. I think there is something lost for white communities, but they've gone searching for it in really unhealthy ways, ones that usually pit them against something else rather than actually directing them into a way that finds their roots. I mean, the social climate of this country has always had this and not them attached. Like, I am this because I am not that is really huge here. I mean, it's always shaped us. So it's not really that surprising when you think about it, that you have a bunch of diffuse people who don't connect to their heritage in any way, shape, or form. And then you have a giant group of agitators come in and go, see, it's these people don't want you to have heritage, which sounds absurd, but I mean, isn't that way it's always been done here?
Right. Well, by erasing people's, you know, link to the past or heritage, I mean, then you can actually come in and be like, well, hey, you're not Irish, you're not Italian, you're not Scottish, you're white. Like, you know, join our team. And, you know, as people have pointed out, there was a system of carrots and sticks. I mean, you know, if you were white, you know, during the creation of whiteness, the racial caste system, and you were able to, you know, get certain privileges and you had certain abilities, you could stop black people on the street and ask for their pass. But at the same time, if you, you know, engaged in a relationship with somebody that was not white, you could face really stiff penalties. So there was reasons to enter into that system, but there were also reasons that you didn't want to catch up with you because there were penalties for you as well.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you look at when these different groups of immigrants from the different areas of Europe that have all been now labeled as white came from, these were all groups that when they were emigrating to the United States were usually leaving because they were on the receiving end of some kind of serious, usually political catastrophe that was a direct consequence of these different state powers flexing their muscles. Like when you look at like one of the biggest waves of German immigration, for example, was during the 1840s when you had all these different political groups across Germany who were staging revolts against different like monarchies and other similar kinds of states and calling for the establishment of democratic republics as well as a democratic United Germany. In the case of the Irish, you had the Irish potato famine, which was caused in part by English landlords and Anglo-Irish landlords deciding that instead of selling grain harvests to the starving people, that it would make more money to sell it abroad and let them suffer because the potato crop had failed so horribly due to the blight. Similar things with Italian immigrants and lots of other groups that were fleeing from different forms of political suppression and political dissidence, and they were coming to somewhere that was saying, okay, we'll take you, but you've got to follow these particular rules and help us maintain this system. If you don't, then, I mean, there's all kinds of examples of anti-German and anti-Irish propaganda from all across the 19th century. Like, there's even this great quote where Benjamin Franklin is railing about those swarthy Swedes.
Those Swedish refugees.
Yep.
And that's what's ironic too, is when you look back at this stuff, it's like we are the product, you know, we are the white trash that they didn't want, that they put over here. You know, like there's going to be rebellions, ship them out. You know, there's going to be plague, ship them out. You know, we need people over there to sell our shit to, or to, you know, create things and send it back here. I mean, and that in itself, I mean, just shits on this idea of nationalism, or especially white nationalism, because there was no, you know, historic project that links, you know, quote unquote white people that were being sent over here. You know, they're just fodder. You know, there was no love that the ruling class in Europe had for people of European descent. I mean, we're just sent over here. So, I mean, just this idea of white nationalism, I think, in its origin story is just such, you know, total bullshit. I mean, it only makes sense, you know, when you think of whiteness in this racial caste system that is America. And, you know, just seeing like races pitted against each other in some struggle for supremacy over control of everything.
This is European conquest 101, is to pick and favor a group over another group. And I mean, like Ryan mentioned, like you could find tons of pictures of people hanging signs in their windows during the big Irish migration from the potato famine. Tons of signs that Irish need not apply. You know, get the mix out of my neighborhood. We don't want to mix with mix, that kind of thing.
Oh, I haven't heard that one.
Disgusting stuff everywhere.
Wow. Well, let's go back to what we were talking about. So the group was formed. You're saying that this stuff has always kind of been here. So how did the group start to push back against organized fascist groups? They're not even organized, just people with fascist or white nationalist or what have you ideas in heathenry. How did that start and what was the reaction?
I think we'll probably disagree about where, but I'd like to submit that the spread of the Circle on Zeus article was probably ground zero for a serious springboard on this issue.
Can you just what was that article and what did it say?
Well, I think the Circle on Zeus is a heathen anarchist collective or something like that, and they just did a lot of collective journalism on Stephen McNallan, the AFA, and like groups and how they were connected, and how they were connected to white supremacist groups, which most people hadn't drawn dots up until that point. And yeah. And there's still people who are reading it and going, oh shit. Right? So it's still that was the thing that was a giant wake up for me. Having read the Circle on Zeus article, I think is how I met Ryan, because I saw Ryan reposting it.
And the thing that struck me about it, like James said, was it all the dots were there. All this stuff was stuff that wasn't exactly like some details, like one particular one that I didn't know about before that one came out, was that McNallan had apparently spent time with mercenaries in South Africa who had been part of an apartheid death squad. I didn't know that one. But there were, most of it was stuff that was known or existed, just nobody had really sat down and gone, hey, look, these aren't things that are happening in isolation.
Yeah, the heathen Boers. There's a friggin' South African Nazi types who've been heathen for quite some time, apparently.
Okay, well, you brought up a name, Stephen, somebody with the AFA. Who is that and what is the group and why is it important for this conversation?
Stephen McNallan was probably the biggest talking head in heathenry for a number of decades, starting from, what would you say, Ryan, about the 70s?
Easily.
He started a couple of different organizations, most of which eventually kind of one phased into another as they developed the... They eventually gave rise to what is currently the AFA. The AFA likes to claim that entire lineage as being a single cohesive unit because it makes them sound older. The biggest accomplishment of McNallan and the AFA is branding their version of racism in terms that make it palatable for people who would otherwise be opposed to racism. We are, in many ways, a religion of converts. We very few of us are born to heathen families and raised this way. It's becoming more common now, but it's especially then in the early days was really rare. And there has been countless studies done on how converts to a religion tend to be just that much more driven to like exemplify everything that the religion is supposed to be. You know, they try that much harder because they didn't start out that way. And one of the things that the AFA did was they sold this myth of folkish orthodoxy. And I don't know if you're familiar with the term folkish. Folkish is specifically in regards to heathenry, the idea that one has to have the correct ancestral bloodline in order to practice heathenry. McNowan is actually famous for coining a term, metagenetics. And this was the idea that religion was passed down specifically through the DNA coded into our very being. And thus, by interbreeding with other people, we would dilute that DNA and lose the religion.
So for them, and real quick, the AFA is the – can somebody just say the name? That was a train wreck. Go ahead one more time.
Ossetru Folk Assembly.
Okay, and we'll talk more in a second about what is Ossetru. Is everybody that's into Ossetru, are they a fascist, blah, blah, blah. But what you were saying back to down to the genetics is that you had to be from a certain place in so-called Europe, Scandinavia, Germany, for it to pass down, or if you're white, however they define it, then you get the metagenetics. How does it work, actually?
In theory,
great question.
This is like a don't ask, don't tell metagenetics thing, or is you just if you have it, you know. If you don't, then you're just shit out of luck.
I think it's that.
In theory, they've like spilled tons of ink and bytes of data defining it. In practice, it tends to follow the paint swatch test.
The what?
Paint swatch test. You must be at least this white to ride this ride.
Okay. All right. Gotcha.
But the AFA did a great job of selling this myth that heathenry, ancient heathenry before the conversion, was this ethnically specific religion that was passed down through the bloodline, and you have to have this ancestral connection to practice. Completely ignores numerous examples from our own history and literature of non-white people coming in and joining the religion, a couple of which were royalty.
and also, he spent an incredible amount of time convincing people in his own circles, even people who, you know, aren't completely clued into his radical ideas, that the biggest thing the worst thing that Christianity ever did to Europe was to essentially erase our tribal ethnic lines, and that Christianity is somehow this force that erases our ethnicity somehow, which is
right.
Incredibly preposterous.
So in many ways, it's almost a better fit for white nationalist ideas, you know, more so than Christianity, because, you know, there's been various fascist interpretations of Christianity, like Matthew Heimbach is a crazy authoritarian traditionalist Christian, and then you have like Christian Identity and all that stuff. But you know, that basically just says if you're not white, then you're a spawn of Satan or, you know, whatever, or some demon. But this is like you get the religion through your DNA, and if you're not white, then you just don't have it, and that's the end of the story.
And it lets them sell it beautifully, because one of the things McDowell was famous for years, and I think he still uses it, was this idea that, like, we can't be racist because we don't hate anyone. Like, right. We don't hate black people. We just think they should worship their own ancestral gods, because why wouldn't you?
Yeah, and they'll say something like, yeah, you could worship our ancestral gods, but then your ancestral gods would feel snubbed, and that would be shitty. Like, that's, like, they'll make you feel guilty for this.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like, it's perfectly fine if you're black, as long as you're black over there somewhere.
So you're saying
there's actually,
go ahead.
There's even one blog post where McNallan explicitly said, shit thee not, drink from your own well. I mean, right. You can't get more Jim Crow spirituality than that.
It's actually worse than that, because he ties to that phrase an entire story about this young man
who was in the 60s and 70s, and he was a hippie, and he was hanging out with Native Americans. And then just because the Natives were like, well, you're not really in our family, so, like, it's the end of the day, and we're going to have a sacred closing ritual, and you need to go, which is totally reasonable. He's like, what? But I'm one of you. And they're like, this old chieftain's like, maybe you need to go drink from your own well. And to him, he takes that and interprets it as, well, that's because I'm not following my racial destiny, and that everyone should drink from their own well. Everyone should drink from their own well. And they make it sound almost... they try to make it sound progressive in one breath.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what a lot of, you know, the alt-right does is, you know, we're like black nationalists, except we're Nazis. how does Asatru kind of resolve the fact that there are many heathenries or, you know, pagan or non-Christian spiritualities within the area known as Europe? I mean, how do they resolve that? I mean, basically, they're creating a whole blanket thing for everybody that's white that's in the U.S., which, again, like you said, is a great package to sell, but it's not exactly... it's revisionism. It's making stuff up, because, I mean, there's literally thousands of spiritual paths and ideas about people, how they're related to nature and so on and so forth.
I think there's two different major answers there. One is how just kind of general heathenry approaches it, which in my experience tends to be people of similar philosophies, even with different theologies, tend to group together. So you get a lot of the more research-oriented Reconstructionist heathens tend to get along well with, like, the more research-oriented Reconstructionist Celtic polytheists. And that's really the end of it. You know, just we have slightly different things, and it's cool that you do your homework. And that's about the end of the conversation. With groups like McNallen and the AFA, they like to specifically try for lack of a better term, whitewash all of Europe. Like, these are now the ancestral gods of all of Europe, and forget the Celts, forget the Baltic regions, forget all of those people. You're all Norse now. Ta-da!
Right. So you went from Braveheart to Vikings, and just like that.
Yep.
Pretty much.
Tell us Scott that. I'm sure they'll be thrilled.
Oh yeah.
It's slightly more nuanced, but it's sort of a, well, I mean, I'm not Nordic, and they're like, are you cool? And they're like, yeah. Well, yeah, fine. As long as you're not black, buddy, it's fine.
Pretty much. I mean, like, McNallen even makes a big deal about the fact that he can trace his lineage back, like, umpteen million generations to Ireland. But that, of course, leaves the big hanging thing of, so, by your logic, why aren't you doing some sort of Gaelic-inspired thing instead of this Scandinavian-ish stuff? And, I think he's actually got, like, some, like, article out there somewhere where he does sort of make the Celts honorary Germanics based solely on hand wavery and the fact that his ancestry mostly goes to Ireland. So it's kind of they mostly kind of dance around the issue or pretend it's not there.
And you're saying that this guy was one of the big movers and shakers within heathen circles for a long time. So did it...
Yeah. He was one of the earliest. Yes.
So was it Heathens United Against Racism that really kind of led the charge against him? Or were people always kind of like, yeah, he's a little out there? Like, I mean, how did it work?
There has kind of been... there's been sort of an understanding that existed before Heathens United Against Racism, but the understanding was always coded in terms of, well, they're folkish, they're more conservative, they have a practice that's a bit different, whereas what we do over here is universalist, we accept everybody, and the sort of unspoken, unwritten agreement of, we're just not going to bother them, and we're going to hope that they don't bother us. how often the second part of that unspoken agreement was actually in force is debatable. And there were some different individuals who have criticized McNallen before Heathens United Against Racism. Heathens United Against Racism was probably the first real organized push to go, hold on a minute. Circle Onsus was the first organized push to be like, hold on a minute. There's something really rotten going on here, and connected all the dots. And then from there, Heathens United Against Racism and some other groups were starting to raise a bit more awareness around the issue, as well as directly pointing out, hey, look, this guy has an official article on his org's website that says that Mexican immigration is actually a holy war commanded by the Aztec gods to wipe out white people, among many other things. Say again?
Oh, I'd forgotten about that one. Sorry, I was just having a chuckle.
Yeah, that one was like one that's like, come on, guys. I mean, that one's still like keeps popping up now and then, and people are always going like, oh my god, have you seen this? There definitely was a change in overall tone before and after Circle Onsus, and then Huar started really organizing and pushing on this, although it wasn't really Huar that managed to actually get a real shift in the consensus. That was something that was actually much more recent by Xander's blog, actually, which I think he can speak to much better.
I think before Xander's, I just wanted to say really quick, from talking to lots and lots of different heathen leaders that just desperately wanted to be neutral on the issue, I learned, like, after a few years of talking to them, that essentially a lot of them understood that McNallen was rotten, but they were afraid that if we all blow the top off of this thing, that we're all going to get painted as fascists, or that everyone will suspect. And you know what? I'm like, well, that's going to happen anyway, isn't it?
that was already happening. Before I was even practicing heathen, first started as like generic paganism in San Diego, there was an active heathen group that I have since found out are actually totally cool, but at the time, because they were heathen, everybody in the San Diego pagan community assumed that they were a bunch of Sieg Heil skinheads. And this was like 15 years ago.
Interesting. So when people started to push back against this stuff through Heathens United Against Racism, How did the other side respond? Like how did they respond to being called white supremacist and fascist and so on and so forth?
Victim card.
Pretending we didn't exist.
When you say Vic card, what do you mean? How did that play out?
Oh, it's the, you know, self-hating liberals, blah 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 blah.
The snowflakes in their safe space.
They don't want us to be who we are. Other people can be who we are, but we can't be who we are. Look at this, poor us, basically. And or if they could get away with it, like Ryan said, just ignoring it.
Well, how did people?
You know, why are black people allowed to have their pride? We're not allowed to have our pride. You know, that kind of argument came up a lot.
Right. Well, how did you all respond to that? Because I think a lot of people that are just neutral would be like, yeah, what's the problem with that? Why can't they have their thing if these other people have their thing?
Well, for me, it was just being intensely to a fault a white person and just showing that, like, yeah, I have all these tribal roots and I'm proud of my family and proud of most of my heritage and blah, blah, blah. And I'm still not on board with all this bullshit. Right? That was basically my way of putting it.
Anybody else?
Well, for me, yeah, we kind of touched on this earlier, but the primary argument that I would usually make, especially against the, you know, why are they allowed to have their pride and we're not, was pointing out, hey, we totally do get to have our own pride celebrations. They're just not called that. You know, every time you go to the Highland Games, congratulations, you're talking about Celtic pride right there.
Right.
And then there's also the fact that, you know, with the African-American community, historically, when they were pulled over here, their ethnic and national identities were completely erased. Like they, by a couple generations in, they had no idea where they were from. Right. They really, all that was left was this shared notion of, you know, we are black because our society tells us we're black and we have this shared ordeal. And that was all the society they had left to them. And so saying that they're not allowed to have, you know, their pride movement is like taking away that one last thing that they've got versus trying to say that, you know, well, we should be allowed to do the same things. Like, except no one stole our ethnic identities from us. You could, you, most of us could still say like, oh, I'm mostly Scots-Irish or I'm German or I'm Scandinavian or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, we also
trace most of our ancestry.
Yeah. I also like to point out the fact that we can trace a portion of our ancestry, but mostly we can trace the literate part of our ancestry, or the part of our ancestry that was tied to a direct community with an actual officially recognized church. Most of our ancestry is a bunch of poor folks who couldn't read or write and will never be known or found. They live in our genes, but we'll never know a thing about them. And most of them faced tremendous amounts of, we'll say, adversity back in old Europe on the basis that they didn't have the right blood, they didn't come from the right stock, or that they were from a different place, one country over. You know, this kind of stuff happened back in Europe. And the fact that these people who call themselves white pride don't understand that speaks volumes. And so revealing this to people or to large numbers of people, when someone calls you out, like you're not proud of your heritage, it's really good to show them that, yeah, you're tracing yourself to a king who's like a dick asshole. If you dig up who that guy was, he sucked. He was mean to everybody you're related to.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And one that also... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to make a joke. He was the Donald Trump of, you know, 2,000 years ago. Like, that's something to be proud of.
Pretty much. Like, the one that I found that I also pointed to along with the ones that James and Xander brought up is this worked especially in California, but also as the gay rights movement had been able to advance and gain more awareness, was pointing to what the essence of gay pride was. And full disclosure, I'm not gay, but I'm grew up in California, so it's something that I'm very aware of. It was something that came out of what we want to do, who it is we are, is something that is actively criminalized and persecuted by broader society. So we are taking pride in this thing that is central to our identity, and in doing so, we are pushing back against the people who would actively deny this to us. And then flipping that around and going, and what do the white pride people talk about? Oh, wait, that they want the right to go out and beat the shit out of anybody who's not white. And clearly showing that these different pride movements, and then building off from that, are ones that rose out of people reclaiming a sense of identity in spite of active oppression and persecution, whereas the white pride movement is really not doing that at all and is doing the exact opposite of saying, well, actually, we'd like more power to be even bigger dicks to everybody else.
They don't word it that way. They're kind of like it's more like, I really don't. He says he can be black pride. Why can't I also say that? It makes me uncomfortable. Damn this whole enterprise.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you brought up the feelings of, or not even feelings, but using that kind of language about victimization. I see a lot of that. I also see a lot of using just kind of like really milquetoast, wimpy, liberal language and stuff like that. Like, I think if you look at what's happening with Augustus Invictus being brought to some libertarian soiree before the Pennsylvania Libertarian Convention, and just people are losing their minds that the hotel has canceled him. I don't know, just the way that people talk about it. I mean, just, you know, just this intense victimization and feeling that they're under siege, and you know, that, that they're surprised that people are upset that, like, that they're fascists. I don't know. It just, it's really bizarre to me, I think, in a lot of ways.
One of my personal favorite things I've ever seen arise out of this resistance to people trying to put down fascism is the anti-fascist pages, of which there's actually a fair number, which just amuses me because it seems like, to me, wouldn't anti-fascist just be fascist?
Right.
It's not fascism.
Like there was a, there's a video that Daryl Lamont Jenkins just put out. It's on It's Going Down. But there's this guy, he's dressed up like he's in Game of Thrones, and he's in this protest in Philadelphia, and he says he's not like on the fascist side or on the anti-fascist side. He's this, just there to like troll people, but he has this sign that has like a Pepe the Frog meme on it. And he said, oh yeah, the anti-fascists over there, they're the real fascists because they want to stop speech. And the Nazis over there, they say dumb stuff, but you know, I just want to be here to respect their right to say whatever it is they have to say. And just like, that just, to me, that's just like such a boring American statement. You know, it's like, you're essentially, you're about nothing. And you're going to literally fight to give people that want to like destroy your freedom to do anything. And you want to give them the ability to do that. I mean, to me, that's just like such an explicitly like American position that it's just so fucking dumb to me. I don't know.
And I think that there's probably a lot who use that as camouflage. I'm sure there's some people who genuinely mean that. But one that actually came to mind when you were talking about that guy was at the Milo et Cal demo. There was a guy who was, and he called himself Eddie Brock, which I'm very sure is not his real name. That's from Spider-Man. That was running around shouting about, oh no, we need to stay nonviolent, and what about free speech? And actually at one point screamed something about, this is all just because a gay man wanted to come and speak at Cal. And was completely ignoring that the headline thing Milo was going to do was going to read off a list of people who were allegedly undocumented immigrants who were studying at Cal, an act that would have probably caused panic and put a lot of people in harm's way. And this guy was also going around, as he was screaming nonviolence, going up and picking fights with people and assaulting people to try to get it on camera. Of, oh no, look at these Antifa, they're the real fascists kind of thing. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's at least, I mean, there's probably quite a few people that genuinely mean that when they say it, but I also wouldn't be surprised if there's people who say it because they want to conceal what it is they're really up to.
Well, is there anything else you want to add as far as just, I mean, let's talk about Declaration 127, correct?
Yes.
And this was a declaration that was written by a variety of heathen, pagan, other such groups that basically said, AFA, fuck off. So how did that happen? What was said inside of it, and what was the ramifications of this happening? Because in a lot of ways, this is, I mean, it was a big deal from what I understand. I'm kind of like an outsider looking in, but it was a very big deal in a lot of ways because it was a lot of groups coming together and saying, like, we don't want you in the clubhouse. Bye-bye.
Pretty much. So back in August of last year, the Austu Folk Assembly, they had recently had a change in management. Stephen McNallan stepped down from his leadership position in the AFA, and they picked up a new leader named Matt. I'm not sure how his name is pronounced. Flavel? Flavel? I've never heard it spoken of.
Your guess is as good as mine.
So one of his first acts as the new Austu Gothi was to issue this big statement on Facebook, which actually I have pulled up here. So today we are bombarded with confusion and messages contrary to the values of our ancestors and our folk. The AFA would like to make it clear that we believe gender is not a social construct. It is a beautiful gift from the holy powers from our ancestors. The AFA celebrates our feminine ladies and masculine gentlemen, and above all, our beautiful white children. The children of the folk are our shining future and the legacy of those men and women of our people back to the beginning. Hail the AFA families now and always. And that's how the fight started. So,
save the white children.
Yeah.
Pretty much paraphrase the 14 words right there.
Right. So this is what led to Declaration 127, or this is in response to it?
This is what led to it.
Okay. So then how did people come together to issue that or write it?
Well, first of all, the way they responded to the response was so ugly. Like, people responded to this post, like people in the AFA, people who were kind of shopping and were thinking about being members. Lots of people responded, and one person in particular was able to respond without being censored, who was of mixed race. And he asked a bunch of very probing questions, and they were very frank with him in a way that I think that whole organization had never been before. They basically told gay people in these responses to fuck off. I asked Matt Flavel, I said, you know, there's a lot of people in the military, in the AFA, who have mixed kids. Is this, what do you think about that? And I got blocked. But when people made white power statements and people pointed out that, hey, you blocked all these people, but you didn't block these kinds of people, Matt Flavel said, I'm just going to call him Flavel. He said that it's their policy not to interfere with white power speech. So he could block my very, very simple question. But if people had white power, if people were doing, quote, white power speech, they weren't going to get in the way. That was a new development that I think had never happened before.
This also, there was an event that happened in January of the same year that I think probably made this a lot more visible than it would have been, where McNallen, posting through his personal Facebook account and not through any official AFA channel, posted up something wistfully saying, we should bring back the Freikorps to stop Muslim immigration in Germany. Which was something that caused its own, like, excuse me, what? Just like a general, like, not so much like an immediate explosion of outrage as a lot of people going, wait, what did you just say? And that, I think, built into this of people were already kind of going, something really weird is going on here.
And around that same time, I think a few months prior, when I want to say 5 months prior, McNallen published his book, and it was being peddled in Europe too. And when he called for the Freikorps, it seemed like almost overnight we got Soldiers Against Odin, or son, was it Children of Odin or Son of Odin?
Soldiers of Odin.
Soldiers of Odin. That overnight we had a multinational organization of douchebags in leather jackets walking around.
Oh God. Yeah. This is after Declaration 127 was published.
Oh, this was all before.
Okay. All right.
This is all the lead up. This had been building for years, and this was basically just the straw that broke the camel's back, and we were able to write it and long enough to get people to actually act on it.
Which is hard
to do in the community.
Did you get a lot of, I mean, was there a lot of like free speech stuff? Like, oh, we've got to protect their free speech to, you know, kill half the world.
Oh yeah, totally. We got a lot of that, mostly from people who didn't actually read the Declaration.
So ironic. It's beautiful.
The Declaration actually specifically states within it that the Austrian Folk Assembly is free to do whatever they want and believe however they want. You know, we can't and wouldn't stop them, but we refuse to associate with them, promote their work, or do business with them ever.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
You know, you can do whatever you want over there because free speech is a thing. And, you know, welcome to America. You're allowed to be an asshole if you want to be. But, you know, we're you know, there, that doesn't exempt you from social consequences.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so a lot of people who said, like, you know, oh, you're just trying to limit their free speech. I'm like, you didn't read this, did you?
No. Yeah.
And that was the entire thing was, you know, the AFA is allowed to be the AFA and we're allowed to close our doors and say, go away. Right. You're not invited to our party anymore. And
there were a lot of people, in addition to the free speech argument, there were a lot of people who were trying to maintain their own sense of moderation by being kind of devil's advocate, like, yeah, well, you know, a lot of white heritage movements do take a lot of flack and blah, 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 or anytime white people try to do anything, blah, 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 who are now on our side, which I thought was a big victory in its own way.
Well, let's talk about that. What was that process like? How did those people that are just kind of like, I don't know, just, you know, in the middle, don't want to take a position, don't want to ruffle any feathers, like what was the process to actually get them to choose a side, literally?
Well, I think from my end, and Ryan probably has some other stories to add to that particular one, but from heathenhof.com, which is the blog hub that I run, we ran two articles on the AFA within about a month of each other. And one was the statement made by the new leader, and it basically just, we went through and found everything in the past, you know, half a dozen years that they'd said that was just horrible racist bullcrap people love to overlook. And we laid it out. Like, we had image captures, we had quotes, we had sound bites, everything all in a row. Like, go ahead, read through this, and you tell me that doesn't sound like a neo-Nazi. And then the second one that we ran was after an event in September where the AFA tried to hold a bloat at Camp Courage, which was their Midwest Fall Fest. And Camp Courage had actually been on the receiving end of a phone campaign due to the local Antifa community that let them know, like, this is a white supremacy group that you're having here. And they decided to close it down and stop them from being able to do that. And the AFA, because of Declaration 127 and because of our last article about the statement they made, assumed it was us.
Right.
And so they started targeting me and Hugues Heathenhoff as, like, the ones who were behind this phone campaign. Even though I found out about it after it was all completed, I was kind of pissed off that I had gotten in on this earlier.
Right.
So I had to look it up. And in doing so, I dug up, like, a whole bunch of connections to, like, this is how the local Antifa found them and what their connections were, which included at least one of their major members who's got his face on the front page of their website being a member of the Golden Gate Skinheads.
Golden State.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, since you brought that up, let's talk about that. What is the connection between the AFA and groups like the GSS, the Golden State Skinheads? If you don't know, the Golden State Skinheads are a group in California. They in Sacramento in June of 2016. I mean, they've organized demonstrations for years, but under the banner of the Traditionalist Worker Party, led by Matthew Heimbach. They organized a rally under their umbrella, and that was the rally in which they were only on the the Capitol grounds for a couple of minutes before they pushed off, but there was a fight, and several people, including several anti-fascists, were stabbed. Currently, there's 106 people that are potentially facing charges if the police have their way. So just a little background. But what is the relationship between the Golden State Skinheads and AFA? And are there other, like, more traditional white supremacist, fascist, white nationalist groups that they have linked with?
Yes. Like, a good way to think of it is the AFA does not discourage their members from also being a member of these different organizations. They have never officially endorsed or embraced any of these groups, but these groups also know that they will have safe harbor with the AFA. They can recruit through the AFA. And there's also been cases, like in 2000, 2010, I want to say, when Richard Spencer's National Policy Institute was holding a shindig in D.C., where a group of AFA members were identified by a journalist who then turned around and was like, hey, what the fuck? There's a bunch of AFA people here. What's the deal with that? And it got back to a number of different pagan news blogs who were like, yeah, what the fuck is up with that? And the official AFA response at the time was, what people do in their own time is their business, and we're not going to penalize them for it. So it's this kind of nodding and winking association of where they're – I mean, I would not be surprised at all, though there has been no hard evidence of this uncovered yet, that there's any that there may be agreements and strategic alliances between the AFA and some of these groups. But there's definitely a clear message and understanding of, if you are part of these organizations, if you organize for these groups, if you quietly promote these groups through the AFA's mechanisms, we're not going to stop you. And we're not going to say anything. And there's actually some AFA regional organizers, they call them folk builders, who have direct ties to some of these groups.
And there's groups that are not directly affiliated with the AFA who have like active neo-Confederate members, like down in the Gulf states. And they'll peddle McNallan's materials, like his books and his words and ideologies. And around the time that started happening, you had group like really scary groups like League of the South suddenly started adopting Nordic baptismal names as almost like a nod and homage to him.
Yeah. Although what's kind of interesting is the same kind of might makes right mentality that runs through the white nationalist community has also tripped up these different groups that are associated with the AFA. Because, as I'm sure anyone listening to this podcast knows, a lot of these different groups do tend to butt heads, if for no other reason than everybody wants to be Führer and nobody wants to submit to the other guy who thinks he's the Führer. So there are some white nationalist groups like the Wolves of Vinland, for example, who adopt a very similar aesthetic and very similar rhetoric to the AFA, who actually have nothing to do with the AFA simply because there are AFA officers that they have ongoing feuds with.
So drama in Nazi town, as is usually the case. All right. Well, you know, I just want to say, go ahead.
Before we close out, does anybody want to talk about how this has become an international problem?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I had a couple more questions, but please, let's get into it.
Well, probably the best symptom of that is the Soldiers of Odin. They have chapters all over two different levels, Scandinavia and the English-speaking world. They also have some elements that are popping up in continental Europe. Although it's kind of entertaining, they call themselves the Soldiers of Odin when the first chapter actually started in Finland, and a lot of Finnish nationalists were like, Odin's a god of the Swedish imperialists, what the fuck? The AFA has also actively been working to spread their influence overseas. There's other groups that they have worked with that do the same thing. Like, one of the most prominent examples is the Comunidad Odinista de España, which does the same thing the AFA does, but in the Spanish-speaking world. They are especially active in Spain, but they also are trying to get their foot in the door all over Latin America to limit access. Latin American heathens tend to be a lot more clued in to that than American heathens are. There's also older than the AFA is the Odinic Rite, who's been around for a while, and they've got groups all over the place, although they tend to be not as big or as well known as the AFA, because they also tend to be a lot more screamingly obvious about what they're about.
We can also mention from Sweden, the NAS, which Xander has had some personal brushes with that are very colorful.
Yeah, that's a fun bag of cats.
What I'm really concerned about
Sorry, why don't you tell that story first?
Oh, no. I want to issue one quick correction. It was mentioned the AFA's presence in Spain being a major branch of their international operation. That actually recently changed. The Spanish AFA, after Flavel, or whatever how it was pronounced, took over leadership, actually broke off. They're no longer with the AFA. So, which I suppose, yeah, that's good news, right?
Do you guys know why?
From what I understand, it was feuds over leadership, just like, you know, the Wolves of Midland, stuff like that. It wasn't like turning over a new leaf. They still do everything pretty much the same way. It was just, you know, oh, we don't like the new guy.
Part of it was also Flavel didn't want to have to explain how many times, if you guys have seen it over the years, so many like American heathens are like, Spanish heathenry, what is that? How, like, they'll talk about, like, look at Spain like it's not a part of Europe.
Well, okay, I'm gonna ask one last question and whatever else you all want to add, but just today on It's Going Down, there was an article that was published that showed a picture with this leader guy from AFA, I assume, and Nathan D'Amigo, the leader of Identity Europa, which is an alt-right neo-Nazi group. I'm just curious, does this signal anything? Are we going to see more crossover between these groups that in the alt-right that are necessarily not tied to any one spirituality or religion and groups like the AFA?
Yes. I mean, in one of his recent videos, like, that was a big thing Mr. McNallen revealed, that he was more interested in the project of keeping the European race alive, as he put it, than he was in the actual project of spiritual heathenry. Like, he signaled very loudly, and this isn't new. I mean, we looked at the NAS, which is a Swedish organization that cropped up rather quickly over the past year. And they have so many ties to the AFA, it's ridiculous. So all these what really concerns me above all is that all of the neutral little spiritual organizations and religious organizations that make up most of heathenry are not internationally connected at a good one-on-one networking basis. But actually, McNallen and his alt-right version, I mean, it's incredibly well networked. It's an international network, and it is growing very tight, very fast, and it does worry me a lot. It's outpacing any work that we've done collectively in heathenry.
The bit that concerns me is that those neutral parties, as you mentioned, the ones that are trying to sit on the fence, so to speak, and say, like, well, I'm gonna play devil's advocate, or I'm gonna try and be in the middle ground, and, you know, I'm sure you both are, you know, crazy on different ends, and it doesn't matter how much evidence you actually provide. You know, my brush with the NAS is a great example. You know, the article I wrote on them, I put in screen caps and video clips. I had a video clip of their head theologian, I say in air quotes, quoting the, you know, paraphrasing the 14 words in a ad for the SDU, which was a group so racist that the Sweden Democrats said, "You're too racist for us." This is the party that is Sweden's version of the Tea Party. They're like, "You're too racist for us. We can't have you going. You're ruining it for us."
Yeah, and I mean, just on that note, you know, a thing that we're seeing more and more, and like if you look at all these reoccurring Trump rallies, is we see at the front of these in a lot of ways, not necessarily organizing them, but definitely taking a very active and confrontational role in them, are alt-right, neo-Nazis, you know, so on and so forth. Like the in Huntington Beach, there was a kid. That was in the melee that was wearing a Base Stick Man t-shirt, the guy that beat up anti-fascist in Berkeley. He was arrested, and he's since become like a alt-right meme. I mean, they were chanting Pinochet as they were, like, you know, fighting with people. And I don't know. I mean, there was like a German battle flags out there in Huntington Beach and so on and so forth. So, I mean, it's like, it's really clear, you know, what's going on, you know, but I think that there's a real hesitance from a lot of Trump supporters to really, you know, confront that. Cause I think for one, they don't want to give up people that are militant on their side. And two, I think that they're so used to being called racist by the media that they are like, whatever, you know, they're going to say that about us anyway. We might as well have everybody we can, especially if they want to fight. So I'm just curious if you have any insights from your experience with that. Like, is there a way to draw that line in the sand and get people to basically push against the really hardcore? Or is that impossible in the situation with Trump supporters?
I think what makes it tricky with Trump supporters versus what was going on in the heathen community is within the heathen community, there had been that long unspoken, let's just not rock each other's boat kind of thing, as well as active efforts to try to cover things up and cover things over. Whereas, I mean, Donald Trump started his presidential campaign by saying Mexico is shipping their rapists and we need to throw them out. Like, he threw away the dog whistle and was grabbing a megaphone from day one. So it's a much harder situation of where we were dealing with groups that were being actively deceptive and working a very sophisticated entryist strategy. These guys are coming in with all the sophistication of the Kool-Aid man.
Right. Yeah.
They're not really hiding what it is they're about. So it's really, it's more a question, I think, of it would have to be more on like individual conversation level, stuff like that. I don't think there's going to necessarily be an easy watershed moment the way we had, where then like a very substantial portion of the people sitting on the fence picked a side and did so decisively. It's going to be more a steady wearing away, and bit by bit people either getting flipped or just dropping out, which is in some way is a much harder thing, because there's not going to be an easy, like, there's no real easy answer to the situation.
Right. I totally agree.
Well, I think with Trump support in general, you kind of have to wait for buyer's remorse to kick in. You have to wait for these people to realize, like, oh, this person whose policies I was supporting is actually doing something that's going to directly affect me. And wait a minute, that's not supposed to happen.
Right. Well, I mean, that's starting to happen. I mean, like, have you all seen the troubadour for Trump guy? He's a big old good old boy. He's got the huge hat that used to go around and sing about Trump. And now his son died, sadly, of an Oxycontin overdose. And have you seen this guy? CNN's been, like, showing him around. But anyway, he used to sing songs about Trump, and like, he actually gave up paying his mortgage so he could follow Trump on the campaign trail, and now he's against Trump because he's opposed to the healthcare plan. And I don't know, there's more and more stories like this. I mean, I follow, for instance, Trump Regrets on Twitter, and there's a lot of funny stuff on there, people regretting voting for Trump. But yeah, definitely, I think there are more and more, especially less ideological right-wing people, but just, you know, middle of the road, kind of pissed off working class and poor people that really wanted things to get better and really were not happy with their conditions in the U.S. and thought that Trump would shake it up because he appeared as this kind of anti-establishment person. And I think there are a lot of people that are becoming more and more upset that they did vote for Trump.
Yeah.
Like, that seems to be the only thing that's really working, is as people see that it's not, that he actually is exactly what he appeared to be, and the other stuff that he was promising is not actually happening, that's probably going to be the thing that flips it more than anything else. I mean,
right.
I wouldn't be surprised if the people that were at, like, the MAGA rallies that happened last Saturday are the hardcore that are going to be coming out for him no matter what.
Right.
But those aren't the people that are going to flip.
Right. Yeah, I guess the question is, it's like, it seems like we're heading into a situation where, like, you could see a shit ton of people flip and a shit ton of people just either stop caring or they're just like, yeah, Trump sucks. I'm sorry I voted for him or whatever. But then still have this massively energized, really hardcore group of people. Because if you look at the rallies themselves, they're not necessarily even about Trump. They're about, like, supporting the role of the police within society, you know, upholding, you know, whiteness, or, you know, this idea of the citizen, or, you know, something like that. I mean, that's really what they're about. I mean, Trump is just kind of like this window dressing that kind of ties it all together. But anyway, I just thought that was interesting. Well, anything else you all want to add? We've been talking for a while. Thanks so much for coming on the show. I mean, there's so much to dig in here. We'll definitely have some links in the notes for the show. But anything else you want to add, or any other places you want to point people to if you want to talk about how to get in contact with Heathens United Against Racism?
Well, I think one thing that definitely deserves stating, just to keep people from getting too terribly discouraged, because let's face it, this this entire situation is somewhat depressing. within Heathenry specifically, it is getting better. We are actually taking steps in the right direction. And sometimes when you're on the forefront of it, that can be hard to see because you're right in the thick of all the fascist assholes. But it is actually improving. A lot of those groups that were trying to maintain that that faux neutrality have really kind of come to see reason, especially if once you provide enough evidence and enough people see it, it starts to pick up momentum. Declaration 127 right now has 170 plus organizations in at least 17 different countries. It outnumbers the AFA by probably at least 10 times as far as just reach and membership and number of people signing on. So it is getting better.
Xander, let me ask you a question real quick. If the AFA would have been allowed to basically stay in heathen circles as they did a couple years ago, do you have any doubt that they would have become much bigger? What do you think the impact of basically ostracizing them from the wider movement has been in regards to their numbers?
I don't think it's had a lot of impact at all on their actual membership numbers. I really don't. They have had some internal struggles, which have really hit their membership numbers, but those aren't things that that we at Hugues Heathen Hof or HUAR can really claim credit for. Those are their internal struggles. I think they've actually had a slight bump in their numbers in Facebook because a lot of the fascist types want to come out in a show of support once, you know, there was a movement against them. I think the biggest impact of the declaration that has been a huge positive force has actually been in the networking of organizations, heathen organizations worldwide that don't stand for this.
And how?
Sorry?
Definitely. Like, that was the thing that's been worrying me for the longest. And before 127, we had just little separate islands of people who didn't want to stand for this crap, who really were barely talking to each other at all. And this brought a lot of people together. And it's a godsend.
It's
turned into a massive dialogue. I'm suddenly in contact with a bunch of heathen groups in Brazil that I didn't know existed before we did this. Like, I had no idea there were heathens in Brazil. I figured on some theoretical level there's probably a couple. I had no idea. It's a very vibrant and growing community down there. And suddenly we're talking to these people regularly. We're hearing the news from their parts of the world and what's going on. What kind of developments are they seeing? And this is the kind of networking that the AFA has been doing for years that, you know, the other side of the spectrum just kind of lacked. And suddenly we're getting together and we're starting to actually build that. And I think that's been the biggest benefit of this declaration.
That's awesome.
One thing that's also been observed is a number of groups that were basically previously the moderate or neutral groups have actively pushed out people who were sympathetic to the AFA party line and taken a much stronger stance. Like, there was like one of the bigger heathen organizations in the United States, the Troth, like, reported that inside their group there were a number of people that previously were members of the Troth and the AFA, that there were a number of members who were posting pictures of burning their AFA membership cards. So even though, like, the AFA itself size-wise probably hasn't changed that much, it seems like what's happened is they've lost a lot of people that were their connections to the heathen community outside of the racist current that they're moving within, and they've picked up more of the racists, but they haven't been able to reestablish those connections that allowed them to maintain the image of respectability for so long.
They also lost a lot of their footholds. Several of their major folk builders, both in the U.S. and internationally, took off after the change in leadership, either just due to conflicts, you know, I don't like the new guy, or in one case I know down in the southeast region of the U.S. towards like Georgia and Florida, their major like linchpin had just become an official like AFA folk builder kindred. And then the statement came out from Matt, and they said, we have people who have like government security clearances, and if we're found to be connected to a hate group, we're risking our jobs. We can't be associated with you people. And so they actually drove off a significant number of their own members without us helping them at all.
Yeah. Anything else y'all want to add? I mean, thanks so much for coming on the show and kind of, you know, providing a window into this world. I mean, it's fascinating. And I think regardless of where people are at as far as, you know, spiritual ideas, I think everybody can relate to this kind of collective community self-defense and everybody kind of coming together. Anything else you want to say?
We do Heathens United Against Racism is doing this is the second time we'll have done this, an international action called Light the Beacons. The first time we did it was last year on May Day, and we're doing it again this year on May Day, of where we are asking people who support inclusive heathen practice to basically light a fire, whether it's like as simple as here's a candle in my room to I am hosting a bonfire in a big public place, and sending in those images as like a show of support as well as a show of strength of the community. When we did it last year, we had group like over 200 different locations participating from all over the world. And we're hoping to get even more this time around. And this is something we feel would be a very powerful show of support as well as community solidarity. Awesome. And of course, it coincides with May Day.
Awesome. How can people follow you online, read your stuff? Get in touch with you.
Check us out on Facebook. Either check out Heathens United Against Racism, or Hugen's Heathen Hof, which is a separate and very critical blog that Xander runs in all like blog role. And that's it. I don't know, how'd you describe it, Xander? I'm grasping at words and failing.
We're a news and blog hub. It's really what we do. We host a bunch of different heathen voices to give different perspectives. We do international heathen news, and we host educational resources.
Awesome. Awesome, y'all.
Look for us. Yeah, look for both on the web and on Facebook. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I would add declaration127.com to any of those who are just kind of interested in looking up what this specific thing that we've been talking about is.
Yeah, and we will have that in the show notes for this, and we'll have it linked and probably give a quote and stuff.
All right. Have a good one.